Hey guys, tonight, as we're talking about this theme of knowing the times and what we should do, what we call the Issachar impact, just like the sons of Issachar knew the times and knew what Israel should do. Tonight we're going to talk about a topic that is very near and dear to my heart. I've been thinking about it a lot since I was a child, really middle school, but I'm trying to make sense of it. And what we're going to do is we're going to talk about the problem with race. And really, you could even say the Christian's problem with race. I don't know really, quite frankly, how any of you think or speak about race. But if you're like a lot of people, this talk will change the way you think about race forever. I'm just going off the feedback I get from lots of people. So with that, I want to just say that we're going to talk about history. Again, focusing on our country, the things that we see, the kind of trajectory we've had in our country regarding race. So we're going to look at history. We're going to talk about science a little bit, and we're going to talk about the Bible at the beginning, at the end, and throughout here and there. But overall, what we're going to see is that we can trust, first of all, we can trust God's word. We should never be afraid to trust God's word. But the second thing is that everything we are seeing around us, arguably in terms of racial division and conflict, hear me on this. This just may be the greatest evangelism opportunity we will ever have in our lives, ever. Maybe things will get more intense and it won't be that way. Maybe this is the beginning of a huge evangelistic boom, a great awakening, so to speak. You'll see what I'm talking about. Right now, the problems we're seeing with race right now are opening the doors for a huge opportunity for an evangelism explosion. And I can't speak for all the congregations of the world, but, and you can't control any congregation but yourself, your own. But mark my words, if we follow Jesus's lead here with this concept of race, we can revolutionize our congregations in terms of growth and that kind of thing. Why am I saying that? Because of something Jesus said in his prayer in John 17. So go with me to John 17. Here at the beginning, we're going to start again with the end game in mind that Jesus prayed for. Now you need to realize, and I'm sure you do, when people are on their deathbed, they don't speak flippantly. Nobody in any TV show or any movie is on their deathbed about to die and they say, "Come here." And they're like, "Yeah, I left the iron on." Like, no one's gonna say that because that's not important. What is important is what we say, what we choose to say and take energy to say when we know we are about to die. Usually in all the movies and TV shows and in real life, tell so-and-so I love them, tell so-and-so I forgive them, or the bad guy might say, "Johnny did this to me," or whatever. But look at what Jesus is praying for on his deathbed. And be clear, he knew it was time. So look at this prayer in John chapter 17, or John chapter 17, beginning in verse 20. "I do not ask on behalf of these alone, but for those also who believe in me through their word." That's talking about all the disciples for all time. Because we are believing the testimony of the apostles and the writers of the New Testament, and our testimonies of those who were there, who told others, who told others. So this is all disciples he's praying for, what he's about to pray for, not just the ones that are right there. Verse 21, "that they may all be one, even as you, Father, are in me and I in you, that they also may be in us, so that the world may believe that you sent me. The glory which you have given me, I have given to them, that they may be one, just as we are one, I and them and you and me, that they may be perfected in unity, so that the world may know that you sent me and loved them, even as you have loved me. Father, I desire that they also, whom you have given me, be with me where I am, so that they may see my glory, which you have given me, for you loved me before the foundation of the world. That's powerful stuff, guys. So based on what I just said, you can, if you buy into what I said about people on their deathbed saying things that are most important to them, then you might surmise that this prayer is going to be about serious, really serious things. And it is. There's lots of things in this prayer that deal with God's glory, the glory given to Christ. And they all have, all this stuff has an element of salvation or keeping people that have been saved so we don't lose them in a lot of different ways. So this is what he's praying for. So what is he saying here? First of all, it's clear that there's a oneness component to God that he wants to extend to us, his disciples, so that we can be one in the Son and the Father, the way they're all. So we're one. And there are two things that Jesus says in his prayer that will happen. Two things, two consequences that will occur if his disciples are one. Those two things are, and maybe you know already, maybe you didn't catch it, but one, people will not believe that God sent Jesus. They will know that Jesus was sent from God in heaven. They will know he's divine in the flesh. And isn't that the big argument about Jesus? People will say, oh, Jesus was a good person. He's a good teacher. But he's not God. That's the big hangup. That's the big hangup. Jesus was a prophet, but he wasn't God. Jesus was a good moral teacher, but he wasn't God. You know what? Everybody I know who says they believe in the morality of the Bible, but they don't believe that Jesus is God, I ask him about the morality and what kind of morals are you talking about? And usually it comes down to lying, stealing, killing, that kind of stuff. That's about it. Maybe adultery. And they get stuck because a lot of the morality Jesus talked about involved following him, to be clear. But so anyway, he wants us to be one, and people will know that Jesus was sent from God in heaven, divine in the flesh, if we are one. Second thing they'll know and not believe is that God loves them the same way he loved the Son, Jesus. There are people that all of us know, whether we know it or not, we know them, whose lives would be changed like that if they really understood how much God loved them and what he was willing to do to give a gift as an extension of that love, this gift of salvation through his Son. If people really knew how much God loved them, there's a whole lot of self-harming behavior and choices that wouldn't be made. People are always trying to fill that hole inside that only God is big enough to fill. And so we do it with pleasure and all that kind of stuff. But anyway, the whole point is oneness. Similar to Psalm 133 that begins, how wonderful it is when the brethren dwell together in unity. So that is the end game. And I wanted to put that out there at the beginning. If we are one, that's why I say this is an evangelism opportunity like maybe we haven't seen before in our lifetime, except for people maybe who lived through the 60s or what have you. But there's a huge opportunity in looking at people the way God does and treating them the way Jesus would were he on earth right now. And when people see the oneness in our community, and it's not even just talking about race. It's not even just talking about race. You know, we do real damage to our oneness when we gossip about our brethren. Not maybe none of you ever do that, but Christians do that sometimes, sad to say. So anyway, you know, my stepmom, as I was thinking about race, I was in 10th grade, maybe 9th, and my stepmom told me she thought there was, and she had a profound impact on my life in a lot of ways, good ways. But she suggested that she thought there was an Adam and Eve for every race. So that got me thinking, well, how many Adam and Eves would there be? How many races are there really? I was taught there was the Mongoloid, the Caucasoid, and the Negroid in one year, but now I see these other races. And so here we have, I want you to just to spell out for you the problem with race that we have and the way these things are exacerbated is because I'm going to give you several things here. Power and politics, prejudice, and the pernicious one. So I was trying to think of a P name for Satan. And the best I could come up with is the word pernicious does appear in the King James Bible for evil. So I call Satan the pernicious one. So Satan, prejudice, and power in politics really aggravate the sores, the emotional scars that have been created by the way we deal with race. And so if you have, I'll prove it to you if you don't believe me. So with that, again, that brings the question, how many races are there? How many Adam and Eves would there have to have been? Well, in the 1990 American census, there were roughly 300 races. 300! There were roughly 600 Native American, or what you then would have called American Indian tribes, and 70 different types of what would they call it on the census then, Hispanics. So where did all this come from? We're going to talk about where it came from, how we got here. So starting out, there was a great taxonomist. He was European. Taxonomy is the naming of different types of animals and such. So Carolus Linnaeus is his name. He created four different races of human beings. He called the first one, this is in the 1700s. He called the first one white. They were the Europeans, or known as Europeans. The second race was red, Native Americans. The third race was dark, and those were the Southeast Asians. And the fourth race was black. They were the Africans. So I need to stop here and give you a disclaimer. Pretty sure I'm going to say some things in this talk that will not be polite language for everybody. And I'm going to say some things that may even cause some conversation in some homes with young children or such. I'm only either using terms that are in a quote or things like that, trying to give you a context. I am not trying to upset anybody, but the truth is the truth. And the history is the history. And we have to understand the history. We can't whitewash history. I mean, you can, but it's not healthy for anybody. So let me tell you what Carolus Linnaeus said about three particular races. He said that the Native Americans were ruled by custom. Africans were indolent and negligent. And the Europeans were inventive and gentle. Which one do you think he was? Right? So the first 100 years of America, we had three categories, roughly the first 100 years on the census. From 1790, for roughly 100 years, we had three, white, black, and Indian. Now, let me ask you something. Why would you have to count people who couldn't vote? Why was the census important? Again, if you know anything about the founding of our country, the two-thirds rule, all that kind of stuff, it was all for power. It was to make sure you could have power. Even if you had people who couldn't vote, you had to count them because it would help you have more power in Congress. So let's step back from a second because our country really has a big black-white thing going on. It has been for a long time. But let's step back and look at the trajectory of several other labels. One would be Asian, Pacific Islander, and Hispanic. So in 1870, there was a new color added to the census, and that was Chinese. So Chinese really is a country or a national origin. But So anyway, we move on. In 1890, Japanese is added as a race or color. In 1920, we have three more races or colors added. I want you to follow. Filipino, Korean, and Hindu. Now, the first four were nationalities, the nations people came from, but they were described as races or colors. But Hindu is a religion. So that's kind of interesting. I think it just helps show we weren't too scientific about the labeling, right, at that time. So that continues till 1977. The government came up with two categories, Asian and Pacific Islander. So that's that, 1977. We'll step back. Let's look at Hispanic. That has been interesting. There's been a lot of pushback on a lot of these labels with what you might call Hispanic. So after the Mexican-American War, there were roughly 8,000 Mexicans or Americans of Mexican descent. And by 1930, Mexican was added as a race. However, there was a huge angry response, and so the government took Mexican off the category of being a race by 1940. That's very relevant, because if it could happen then, it could easily happen now. So anyway, and that might be something we want to think about for those of us who are moved by this kind of thing. So by 1977, the government came up with a label called Hispanic. Now, there was a study done, and others have been consistent, but I know for sure there was one done in 2012, a survey that showed the majority of people who would be called Hispanic don't want to be called Hispanic. That's interesting. So why are we doing it if most people don't want to even be called the label? So in the 70s, there was a report called USA by the Numbers, and there were only three races listed. However, this is before 1977, the early 70s. But under the abortion section, there were only two categories, white and non-white. Why is that? Well, first of all, nobody can agree on how many races there are, but we'll get back to that abortion question. Why would the abortion category only have two races, white and non-white? We'll talk about that in a second. So let me just give you some observations made by some evolutionists. So Stephen Jay Gould, renowned evolutionist from Harvard, said this. When I say evolutionist, I mean Darwinian evolutionist, meaning that he does not ascribe to the biblical account of creation in any way, shape, or form. He buys into Darwinism hook, line, and sinker. So here's what he said. Biological arguments for racism may have been common before 1850, but they increased by orders of magnitude following the acceptance of evolutionary theory. What that means is evolutionary theory, Darwin's theory, helped people become, like, use biology as a basis for being a racist. So as we move on, here's a great question in light of what Stephen Jay Gould just said. Why would you use biology and genetics to justify the racial categories when the racial categories existed before the study of genetics? You follow me? They used crude biology assumptions and whatever as a basis for the racial categories that existed. And so now that we really do have some serious genetic studies, some of you probably know about the Human Genome Project. In this generation, that it revolutionized everything. I have a friend, he said his daughter came home from college after the Human Genome Project and said, "Dad, do you know there's no races? Because the Human Genome Project proved genetically what the Bible has always said, that the whole human race came from an original one man and one woman." So we don't have to have the Human Genome Project to prove that. We can trust God. And so let me ask you this. In a group setting, I love asking this question. Darwin's most famous book is called The Origin of Species, but most people don't know the full name of the book. So just think, if you know anything that comes after that first part, The Origin of Species, I'm only going to give you the relevant part of the title. It was very long, but I'm going to give you the relevant part that might open your eyes a little bit. Darwin's book, The Origin of Species and the Preservation of Favored Races. It wasn't just trying to figure out where we came from. It was about the preservation of favored races. Darwin's cousin was one of the premier eugenicists ever. Eugenics is what Hitler was trying to do, create a super race. And so Darwin, when Stephen Jay Gould says Darwin helped promote, like put gasoline on the fire of racism, he really did. And so let's talk about, there's a lot of manifestations of that. Hitler was a fan of Darwin and used a lot of evolutionary theory as a justification for the things he did. But let's just talk about an American woman named Margaret Sanger. So imagine people who were buying into our evolutionary theory and thinking that the races that we had, some were superior, some were not. And so I'm going to read to you, before I tell you about Margaret Sanger, you know what? I'll wait a second on that. So if you don't know who Margaret Sanger is, she is somebody who, her first organization she started was called the National Birth Control League. See, back in the day when everybody ordered things from catalogs more than they went to the store, you could not mail birth control through the post office or through the postal system. It was against the law. And so she started promoting the idea of using birth control. Later on, as technology grew and science grew and she was able to access abortions, she started something called Planned Parenthood. So both organizations were created with the idea of limiting certain people that we didn't want to have. So let me give you some examples. I'm going to share some things with you that are troubling elements of our American history. This is the woman who, the National Birth Control League was the beginning, then Planned Parenthood, which is really just an abortion factory. So she created something called the Negro Project. If I would ask you if I was in person, do you know what the Negro Project is? The Negro Project was something she created where African-American women unknowingly were being sterilized. She was sterilizing unknowing black women, as well as other people. She was sterilizing other people that she deemed as undesirables of society. Something Margaret Sanger said, and she said many statements like this. She said, again, I'm not trying to offend anybody, but she said, colored people are like human weeds and are to be exterminated. She also said, too many Negroes are born yearly. She also said, we can't let it get out that we want to exterminate the Negro race. That was in writing. She also wanted to have a license for parents, for mothers, before they could have children. The government should give parents a license before they can. That's what exactly what Hillary Clinton wanted to do after Bill Clinton, right after Bill Clinton became president. You want, did that idea leave her mind? Who knows? But that's why there was a lot of to-do in recent years about the United Nations talking about the rights of a child, taking away a parent's right to decide things for their children. If we ever get so involved with the United Nations that way and the rights, we'd be giving away parental rights to the United Nations to decide what we can do. It's just horrible stuff. We've got to pay attention to this kind of thing because our rights as parents are not given by the government. They are given to us by God. So as we go on, Ruth Bader Ginsburg just passed away. There are some, she's a really interesting person, but let me tell you what she said about Roe versus Wade, which legalized abortion across the country. She said in 2009, This is 11 years ago. She said, frankly, I had thought that at the time Roe was decided, there was concern about population growth, and particularly growth in populations that we don't want to have too many of. She's one of them. She understood. She knew the deal. So understanding that, Margaret Sanger is not the only disciple of Darwin to really target minorities of various sorts. You wonder why, to this day, roughly two-thirds to three-fourths of all Planned Parenthood clinics are in what might be called a black neighborhood. Because they were targeted from the beginning. And you know how this is very relevant to Christians. You know how they targeted people? Or quote unquote Christian preachers in quote unquote black churches to get them to encourage their members to do the things to limit their population. It's very sad. It's very sad. People are being bought off, paid off. So let's step away from that history, which is really, really sad history. Let me ask you a question. I want you to think about if you've ever thought of people the way everyone talks about them, like black and white, whatever, and you use crayons. I mean, I've done this as a kid, and I thought this, I grabbed the black crayon to draw one person, and I grabbed the white crayon to draw another person. And as I'm drawing, I'm thinking, that's not what it looks like. And I was a little know-it-all kid, and I was a little smart aleck. So I would argue with kids. Somebody would say, I'm white. And I would say, no, you're not. I'd hold the crayon up and say, you're peach. And so I was just a smart aleck, and I was trying, that was my thing. But I know I'm not the only person that felt that way or had that experience where something went ajar in your brain and the way you thought the world was because the crayon didn't match. You had to get creative and really think, what crayon do I use to draw this person? The labels do a number on us. So in the 1940s, a renowned world-famous anthropologist, Ashley Montague, said race is our most dangerous myth. So C. Loring Brace, who's an anthropologist at the University of Michigan, he's also a curator of biological anthropology at the University of at the university's Museum of Anthropology, he would say we should have two races, the sickle cell gene race and the healthy hemoglobin race. And he would say we'd have Africans around the equator, Greeks and Italians, who are the sickle cell race, and everybody else would be the healthy hemoglobin race, including Nelson Mandela's Xhosa tribe, and the Swedes and the Norwegians would all be in the same race. Some people have said, what if we create races based on the epicanthic fold in the eye? And that way, we'd have Japanese and Chinese and the Kukungsan tribe in Africa, which are also famously known as the Bushmen, they would have those eyes, and everybody else would be in the other race. Here's the thing. The racial categories are bogus biologically. I went to college in the 90s, and in my sociology textbook, it said race is not a biological concept. It's a cultural concept is what it said. Cultural. So even then, I thought to myself, that means Bill Clinton could be one race and his wife could be another and all this other stuff. I started thinking about this stuff. So why are they teaching race as a concept if biologically it does not hold water? Power and politics, prejudice, and the pernicious one. So as we move on, if you take a quote unquote average white person and an average black person in America on the street, they will have more in common genetically than two black people and two white people, quote unquote, so-called. So in 1996, and the American Anthropological Association submitted what they called a statement on race. They were trying to get the government to remove racial categories from the census, saying it was all washed up. It's bogus. Look it up. It's really profound, but it says things that in your gut, you probably know to be true. So I'm going to, all right, let me, okay. So let me read to you this last thing I'll read to you before we move on. Let me read to you what was in textbooks, school textbooks, from shortly after World War I to the late 50s, early 60s. This was a definition of the races of man. So people for about two generations got this teaching about the races of men. Some of this may sound familiar to some of you. At the present time, there exists upon the earth five races and varieties of man, each very different from each other in instincts, social custom, and to an extent in structure. These are the Ethiopian or Negro type, originating in Africa, the Malay or brown race from the islands of the Pacific, the American Indian, the Mongolian or yellow race, including the natives of China, Japan, and the Eskimos, and finally, the highest type of all, this is a quote, the Caucasians, represented by the civilized white inhabitants of Europe and America. And you wonder why some parents might say to a guy who might have a darker hue, you can't date my daughter. You can't marry, you surely can't marry my sister, whatever. So that's a lot of information. So I want to take you to something else here. We're going to move on. I'm going to show you some slides I have. So go with me here. And I'm going to show you the slides for this. Here we go, right here. There we go. All right. So I got to the question I showed you. If the Adam and Eve story is true, why are there so many races? Big question. A lot of people have that question, by the way. A lot of non-Christians have this question. Trust me. That's why I did it that way. I first did this talk for USF. I was invited to speak to students at USF. We invited humanist associations and all kinds of evolutionists, and we had a discussion afterward. It was dynamic. Set up a Bible study with one of those guys too, who called himself an anti-theist. So anyway, we'll tell you about that later. But, so look at these colors for the races that people have usually used. So, as we go on, look at the people that would fit these categories. Now, I know that woman with the glasses is very pale, but even she's not white. So, if you look at me, see my coat? My coat is black. If somebody's skin is black, they are not doing well. They're about to lose an appendage of some sort, maybe, or something else, but it's not good. See my shirt? My shirt is white. Nobody is the color of my coat or my shirt. And nobody has white skin. Now, what about albinos? That's not normative. That's an aberration of the, but anyway, even albinos aren't white. So I want to just say, nobody is like this. Now, what do we do with the song? Red and yellow, black and white, they are precious in his sight. In the song, so this may be uncomfortable for some people, but I just want to recognize first, the spirit of that song is exactly what Jesus prayed for in John 17 that we read earlier. However, I don't have my kids sing this song that way. I just don't. I even saw a Facebook discussion in the last few months where people were trying to figure out the best way to sing this song. And they weren't influenced by me, I don't think. Maybe they were. These were Christians. Every color, dark to light, or they were thinking of all these different variations. But why don't I teach my kids to sing this song this way, red, yellow, black, and white? I'll explain in a second. So it's based on false assumptions, or false understanding of what race really is. So let's go on. The reason I say that it's based on a false assumption is these colors have been given definitions by God. Look at the definitions of the color red in the Bible. Sinful, Isaiah 1:18. Death, Revelation 6:4, verse 4. War, Nahum chapter 2, verse 3. Satan, Revelation chapter 12, verse 3. Temptation, Genesis 25, verse 30, and Proverbs chapter 23, verse 31. What about black? God gives definitions to the color black. God's eternal judgment, Jude chapter 1, or Jude only has one chapter, Jude verses 12 and 13. Disease, Job 30, verse 30. Famine, Revelation chapter 6, verses 5 and 6. Poverty and death, Lamentations chapter 4, verses 8 and 9. God's wrath, Revelation chapter 6, verses 11 through 13. Sin, Job chapter 6, verses 15 through 16. Let's see what God gives as definitions of the color of white. You already know where I'm going. You already know some of these verses. Purity, Psalm 51, verse 7. Cleanliness, Psalm 51, verse 7. Sinless, Isaiah chapter 1, verse 18. Victory, Revelation chapter 6, verses 1 through 3. Joy, Ecclesiastes chapter 9, verse 8. I'm saying this in case some people can't see the video in the future. They want to listen or hear it back. Righteous or heavenly. Matthew chapter 17, verse 2, John chapter 20, verse 12, Revelation chapter 3, verses 4 and 5, and verse 18, chapter 4, verse 4, chapter 6, verse 11, chapter 7, verse 9. Please note, there is no good definition given by God for black or red. Please note, there is no bad definition given by God for white. And please note, the way we use these colors for people did not exist on any kind of large scale, universal scale, until the colonialists and the explorers from several hundred years ago went to different portions of the world and got people that looked very different in contrast and brought them together in the Americas. That, or at least that was the big impetus for it. See, if you walk from Europe to Asia, you'll see, or the southern part of Africa, you'll see gradual changes in how people look. But when you do the exploring, you see the contrast, and they're just different than us. They're just different. Let me show you something. Let's talk about biology for a second. Look at this chart. You see the capital letters in the upper left-hand corner and the lowercase letters in the lower right-hand corner? Okay, what I want you to notice, this is a very simplified explanation of the biology of what we have come to recognize as skin. I have a bunch of other quotes I can give you from people that say race is really just physical exterior qualities that we've been trained to recognize. And you know this because if you do some searching, or maybe you don't know this has happened, there's been a number of inventive teachers and creative teachers who have tried to create the opposite effect of what has existed in with regard to prejudice by say turning all the blue-eyed children into the looked down upon children, and the privileged children are the ones with brown eyes. It is scary how fast those children adapt. So what this means is if all you have in your gene pool is a capital A in the upper left-hand corner, capital A. Let me see if I can show you. Yeah, if you can see that. Capital A and two capital Bs, and you marry some, And you marry somebody who also has two capital A's and two capital B's with representative of the melanin in their skin, because melanin is just brown. We all just are shades of either dark or light brown based on the amount of melanin we have in our skin. So if one person in the upper left-hand corner marries another person in the upper left-hand corner, and that's what they have to represent the melanin in their skin, they will only be able to have children with really dark skin. The converse is true with people who only have lowercase a and lowercase b. They marry someone else similarly, they will only be able to replicate themselves with somebody with fair skin. However, look in the middle. If, let's say, look in the middle box. if you see somebody who has two capital A's and two lowercase b's, and they're in what you might call a middle brown type skin tone, maybe similar to me. And then you have somebody who doesn't have any capital A's, but they have two small A's and two capital B's. These two groups of people, or a lot of these middle brown people, not all of them, they can create any shade. They're a middle brown complexion, and they can create people from the darkest skin tone to the lightest skin tone with regard to melanin. Isn't that interesting? And most people in the world, by the way, are middle brown, which you might call middle brown. But from science and genetics, what we learn is that if the Bible, if the Adam and Eve story is true, and if the Human Genome Project is true, which we know it is from science, because it's science and we know that, then we all come from one man, one woman. And what that means genetically is Adam and Eve would have had to have been in that middle brown category, where together in one generation, they could have had, with one generation, with no grandchildren, they could have had the spectrum of skin color. Let me tell you something. Oh, you know, you can see my family if you want, if you go on Facebook or what have you. But last time I did this talk, I meant to like put my family's picture in there. So my oldest daughter has very fair skin. She has blue eyes. My wife and I both have brown eyes. You have to go back to my wife's grandparents to get blue eyes. My mom had blue eyes. So she had blue eyes. It was black hair when she was born. It fell out a month later and grew back bleach blonde. And it kind of has mellowed out into like a medium brown. And my next daughter was darker. My third child, my son, he's a lot darker than I am. And my wife is a lot fairer than I am. And so what scientists have discovered is that about 15% of the people, they estimate about 15% of the people that might be considered middle brown have the capacity to create a variety of skin tones. So all these categories, let me show you something. This is how many atoms there are in the universe. This is how many electrons there are in the universe. This is how many possible children two people can have without duplicates, without genetic duplicates. So let's talk about the futility of this real quick, all the history we have. If race was a viable concept, then why do people from all over the globe claim me as their genetic relative? Let's just start in America. People assumed they would have even called me black or mixed biracial in Minnesota. In Florida, everybody assumes I'm Puerto Rican, sometimes Cuban. But I've had people from all over the world claim me, from the Lumbee Indians in North Carolina to various countries throughout the South America and even Mexico, to Portuguese, to Sicilian, to Greek, to Middle Eastern. And there's others, but I want to tell you something. Because I buy into the science and I buy into the Bible, I never really answer that question. Because people, here's what happens. With me, see, I recognize that I have a certain ambiguity to how I look. And I don't, well, it's basically, the reason I don't answer the question, quite honestly, it's my passive aggressive way to force people to look at me the way God does. Some people need to know how to categorize me. They just do. And I always get the look. Let me tell you, they'll give me a look, look at me. And I know it's coming. As soon as they give me the look, I know what they're going to say. Look at me and say, "What are you?" It even happened for my college. I was a manager for the basketball team. And for some reason I had to walk. We were at the National Small College Basketball Tournament in Salina, Kansas for a week. And I had to wash all the jerseys every day. So I'm carrying these two bags of big clothes about two blocks down. I'm walking down to the laundromat. This police officer stopped me and it was dark. So she shined the flashlight in my face and she said, "What are you doing?" And I said, I work with a basketball team for this tournament. And I'm bringing my jerseys and laundry here to wash. So she looked at me and gave me the look, and she said, "What are you? Black? Hispanic? Dark white?" So I didn't even know dark white was a category, but I guess to her it was. So let me just say something real quick. Let's go back here. See these definitions we were talking about on the slides? Is it any wonder why in the 60s you had people like Malcolm X saying things that Christianity was a white man's religion? So he was famous. He also was very prominent and got a lot of followers by saying rich dirt is black dirt. Strong coffee is black coffee. So I used to listen to a lot of rap when I was young, and there was a rap group that when I was young that had a line that went like this. Black cat is bad luck. Bad guys wear black. Must have been a white guy who started all that. So you wonder who wants to be called these, who wants to have association with these terms? Disease and famine, death, God's judgment. And if people call you, so here's the thing. If we embrace this term, black, and then people become Christians and they start seeing these definitions, it may trouble them to some degree. And they may not even tell you about it, but it's one of the reasons why some people say Christianity is a white man's religion and that it was used to enslave Africans. So Malcolm X even said this to try to flip the way people were thinking. He said, it's like when you have some coffee that's too black, which means it's too strong. What do? You integrate it with cream. You make it weak. If you put in enough cream, you won't even ever know you had coffee. He says, it was hot, it became cool. It was strong, it became weak. It used to wake you up, and now it'll put you to sleep. And the whole crowd's like, ah! He's merely taking advantage of the game the way he was born into. And you think about this, the Negro Project and all those things, you wonder why there's a lot of rage in African Americans right now. You wonder why there's this pent up rage. I've been in some churches, nobody even knew some of these things were going on in history about sterilizing black women, quote unquote black women, or what have you. That there was this agenda. If you want to read more about that agenda, go to blackgenocide.org. Blackgenocide.org. Some of this information ought to at least give you a little compassion, which, by the way, is the emotion the Bible says Jesus had for people more than any other emotion, more than love. He had compassion on them because they didn't have leaders. He had compassion on them because they just didn't understand, what have you. If you grow up in this system and you think this is your label, black, and you feel some of these things, you can't even put your finger on it, but in Christianity you feel some of these things, and you know some of the history, like the Tuskegee experiment where they were giving men. They were letting men, they thought they told men they were going to heal them of syphilis, but they didn't. They just let them have it and let it ravage their bodies. And Bill Clinton actually offered an official apology for the Tuskegee experiment. I mean, you may not even know what it is. But when we have these colors, how healthy do you think it is when we ask things like, oh, is that a black church or a white church? Black preacher, white preacher. The civil rights movement was taking advantage of the way the colors were expressed, but nobody has understood until recently that these colors used for racial categories are completely bogus. We are taking colors given definitions by God and ascribing them to people groups. Why would we do that? Oh, power and politics, prejudice. I'm better than you, and the pernicious one. So as we're wrapping up, we got a few minutes left. It's been a while, but I really appreciate your patience. So some people will ask, oh, let me show you one last thing in these slides to show you the amount of differentiations we have in people. And people who are middle brown can create various skin tones. Let me show you some pictures. So Newsweek one time had a picture. This was the cover. What color is black? All these people identified as black, but you can see some of them are very fair skinned, right? How legitimate is that a term black for people like this? So here are two kids that are twins. The one is not an albino. They are twins. Isn't that interesting? They look similar too, don't they? So how can you have two kids that are two different races? How legitimate is that? Right here. Two middle brown people had two twins. One blonde, one darker skin and darker hair. Isn't that interesting? And you can tell they're twins, not an albino. By the way, you know how many people come up to me and ask me if my kids are mine? One time my oldest daughter, I was playing with her because, you know, I'm a good dad. No, I'm just kidding. But we were at a restaurant and I was playing with her, feeding her, and I got up to use the restroom and the woman at the next booth was smiling. She was older. She smiled and looked at my wife and said, he's really good with her. And she said, oh yeah, thanks. And my daughter was maybe one and a half. And she said, how long has she known him? And she said, well, he's her dad. And she's like, oh, sorry. And so, anyway, it is what it is. These guys are twins. Not an albino. These two are twins, not an albino. But you can see, you can tell they're from the same family. You can even see the fair-skinned girl has really thick, curly hair. It even looks curlier than the girl with the brown skin. Now, this is an interesting one. So this happened in Nigeria. And if you're, I don't know if you're looking at my slide, but when you read the article, you see that the father, when the baby came out, the father just sat there like this. And the doctor got concerned, thinking he had stumbled across like an adultery situation. But if you read the article, he said, you know, the baby looks like all my other kids, just fair skinned. Again, not an albino. Here's an interesting one. These two girls, older girls, this happened twice in the same family. You had two sets of twins, and both twins would be considered different races. Same parents for both sets of twins, and here they are. Similar to me and my wife, although my wife's not blonde. She has dark hair, brown hair. But you had a middle brown person with a fair-skinned person, and they had that phenomenon. So, how could this happen? Here, some people will say, well, why does everybody in China look the same? Well, first I would say not everybody in China looks the same, but I know what you mean. So how did that happen? So let me just stop and let's ask a question. Has anybody, I'm going to stop sharing this real quick. Oh, there you go. So has anybody, can you think of anything in history where people would have gotten segmented biologically and only intermarried within their little segment that got divided? You're already ahead of me. I know some of you are thinking Tower of Babel. Absolutely. So when you count the people groups divided in the Tower of Babel, they are roughly the same amount of languages that linguists say began, were the original languages. But you know what God said in the Tower of Babel? God made the observation that when the people are one, when the people are united, they can do anything. But they were united for a vainglorious cause. They were united for a satanic purpose. So God separated them, confused the languages, and we were divided. And if you can only speak to a certain amount of people, that will isolate certain genes. And so you're going to be isolated based on where you move. And so now let me say this. The races did not come from evolution. That's what I used to believe. I used to believe, oh yeah, in the equator in Africa, they have dark skin to protect from the heat. Because I used to be an evolutionist before I was a Christian. They have thick, curly hair to block the sun and the heat and wide nostrils because the air is thicker and the humidity and the heat. And people in Scandinavia have long hair to keep them warm in the cold. And they have longer nostrils and noses to warm up the cold air. I mean, this isn't stuff I just thought of. I read this somewhere. So that's what I believed. And that kind of thing. They have fair skin because they don't need to protect themselves from the sun. They need to get all the vitamin D they can get. Because when you have dark skin, it blocks vitamin D. Well, I never thought about the other hemisphere and how the people around the equator in South America have straight hair. And they're not as dark as the people in Africa. Or how the Inuit Indians in the tundra have darker skin than the Scandinavians and wider nostrils than the Scandinavians, but they're living in the cold. So I didn't think. So some people will say it's microevolution, not macroevolution. No, because Darwinian evolution is the premise that new genetic information is released into the gene pool over time. New information. We're not talking about mutations. We're talking about new genetic information. But that's not what happens. We learn from science. It's a narrowing of the genetic information that isolates certain people groups into how they look. And when you go back in time, there would of necessity, see the biologists get it, they know, there would of necessity have been a wider selection of genes to come to choose from for God with Adam and Eve. So as they got separated with Tower of Babel, I surmise that is where we got the separate groups that ended up looking very similarly, even with some concepts Darwin was right about, like natural selection. The hotter climates attracted people who could withstand that. The colder climates attracted people that were more designed for that. And Lucy, who, if you look up Lucy, if you know who Lucy is, you understand. But if not, look it up. Lucy, who they say was this prehistoric person, is in Europe. But the bones also resemble somebody who had rickets. Well, what helps cause rickets? A vitamin D deficiency, which is what could happen if you're really dark-skinned and you live in a place where the sun doesn't come out as much as it does around the equator. And so you have Lucy, who I believe, and many, many people smarter than me believe, is really just a dark-skinned person with rickets. So anyway, with that, with Tower of Babel, let me just say, God reversed the curse of the Tower of Babel in Acts chapter 2. He reversed it. And it's a symbol that you were divided. Now by the uniting of the languages, it's time for my people to be one. It's time for the gospel that was preached to Abraham by being blessed through his seed for everybody from all the nations to be one. And I have reversed the curse of the languages to prove it. See, when God said that when the people are one, they can do anything, oneness is power. We can do anything when we are one. So says God at the Tower of Babel. But as a result, the consequence also is people will be united and people will know that Jesus was sent from God in heaven and know that God loves them. So let's talk about Black Lives Matter for a minute before we close and we'll wrap it up. Best marketing plan in history, in my opinion. Because if you go to somebody with a halfway decent heart and say, do Black Lives Matter? They'll get angry with you and say, "What? Of course they do. What are you talking about? Don't ask me that question. Of course they do." So you take that statement and it's, again, we're piggybacking off of a multi-generational resentment toward the prejudice that has existed with put toward people who wear the label black. And we're piggybacking off of people's compassion. See, we've grown up in a culture where God's light has taught us to be good and kind and compassionate. And then you take an organization that you don't have to do much research to figure out these ladies are communists. And Black Lives Matter has actually scrubbed their website. Because on their website, they talked about various things, how they were against the nuclear family and how the more checks you could put next to your labels, like if you're like them, black woman, homosexual, you're more important. They didn't use the word important, but that's what they were trying to say. Your voice is more relevant and should be paid attention to more than somebody who can't check all those boxes. Some of that stuff's been scrubbed, especially the stuff about the family. And so you have an organization that is communist in nature. Why are they against the family? Why are they against things like that? Because you know what Marx said you had to do to create a communist society? Karl Marx said in the Communist Manifesto, you had to sever the hallowed bond between parent and child. That's why people who are communist or socialist or lean in that direction are wanting not the parents to raise the children, but the community. That's the whole goal. And so anyway, we don't have to be angry to be a kind person. And we don't have to buy into riots and violence. We don't have to buy into the organization to show kindness to people. And a lot of people, there was a person that I care very much about. I encourage her to listen to this talk tonight. And she told me that she felt like the Bible taught people to be abusive and that kind of in the name of righteousness. And that's what has created a lot of racial stuff. Have people abused other people? Absolutely. It's hard to wash off the sinful tendencies of the culture or ourselves. But be clear. Do Black Lives Matter? Well, I would say I'm such a know-it-all or nitpicky person. Like just like a kid with a crayon, I would say it's a false statement because there's nobody really black. But I understand what you're saying. Everybody's lives matter, of course. But why would you say that? There's an agenda going on. And just like with Margaret Sanger, there are good-hearted people being used by the communists behind the organization Black Lives Matter for their agenda, and they are going to get discarded as soon as if Black Lives Matter organization gets their way, they'll be discarded quickly. This will be the last thing I say about it, then we'll close. So Stalin is a famous communist leader responsible for maybe over 100 million deaths in the last century. Maybe not, maybe 50 million, but there's debates about it. But who kept records like that? You know what I mean? So he talked about how to promote communism, you had to have useful idiots. That's his term, useful idiots. Well, let me just say, African Americans have been targeted by communists as being their useful idiots since shortly after World War II. It's that way. That's why you see a lot of civil rights activists that are leaning socialist or communist back in the 50s and 60s, because they were being trained. Didn't take much. You're in a society where you are being marginalized and someone shows you compassion and shows you some ideal. So we'll talk a little more a bit about that tomorrow, but I just wanted to say we can conquer this problem in our community, in our church, in our families. We cannot control everybody else. I don't encourage you to try to control everybody else. I encourage you to control what you can control, and that's you. You can influence your family. We have our church, and we can influence our community around us. Let me tell you, you don't have to do any song and dance to attract minorities. People who have been marginalized can tell when somebody really looks at them as they ought to, the way God would. They can just tell. Similar to how a woman can tell when her opinion is being marginalized or not respected by a man because she's a woman. It's hard to say, but you just kind of know sometimes. Sometimes you don't. Again, all I'm saying right now is there is a way we can impact the world, and this is a huge opportunity. And being one, the Bible only, I'm not going to read it for sake of time, but the Bible only gives one place where we can be one, where we learn how to be one in Christ. And that's Galatians chapter 3. Based upon our faith, as is expressed in chapter 3, verse 26. Verse 27 says, we all of us who have been baptized into Christ have put on Christ. And then it says there's neither male nor female, or you might think black or white, neither slave nor free, red, yellow, what have you. You go on, and we all become Abraham's children with an inheritance. That's what everybody needs. That's what everybody wants. We don't have to play the game of all these politicians and people trying to take over our country and people trying to fight for our country. We fight for Christ and we fight for his kingdom, and we can impact any community around us, if we will look at people the way God says to look at them, the way he coached Samuel to look at David and the kid from Jesse that no one wanted to give a chance to be king. He said to him, you look at the outer man, but I look at the heart. Because God's thoughts are higher than our thoughts and his ways are higher than our ways. Isaiah 55:9-10. So with that is my lesson. The problem with race for Christians is there is no biological race. Because in God's eyes, there's two races of people. God's people and not God's people. And it's our job to unite them both inside the body of Christ. That's the problem. All these false presumptions about the colors and this and that, and the church buys into it. Again, that song, the spirit of that is everything Jesus prayed for. But I encourage everybody here today, Yes, it will be challenging to change our vocabulary. But why do you have to address it? There's a lot of times, you know how many times I've heard someone say, yeah, I was here at the store and this black guy walked in and then something else, and they say something that doesn't even matter to the fact the guy was quote unquote black. They just bring it up. Well, why was that relevant to the story? It may be sometimes, but you know how many people do that? And it's not even relevant to the story. All that shows is I see that person as different enough that I must identify him as different. And it may be out of habit. You may not even realize you're doing it. But don't do that. Just refer to people how they are in the Bible, by their nation, by their tribe, or their family name, what have you. You know how many people, this will be my last thing I promise I'll say about it. You know how many people have asked me, what are you? And when I say, I'm American, they'll say, and this is multiple people in different states, will say, you can't be American. You have to have something in you. It's based on an assumption of what an American is. It's based on, let me tell you, I get that from both my conservative and liberal friends. So please don't think this is a conservative or liberal thing. I get conservatives and liberals that refuse to accept my label of American. And they want to know. They really need to know. And it's so refreshing to me when people don't need to know. I just want to say that. I'm a child of God. And I want everybody else to be one too. Thank you so much for your time.